This week, we're continuing our look at Max Heindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation as we read Chapter 2, The Brazen Altar and Laver. What does the brazen altar symbolize? What was the laver? And how is it related to Atlantis? Then, an all-new Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. What if a brother was leader of a country and banned Freemasonry and then brought it back and then banned it again? This week, you'll hear all about it. We'll wrap it up with a December newsletter from 1934, written by none other than Manly P. Hall. In it, he discusses the threefold nature of consciousness and the Kabbalistic ties to modern psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 476, the last episode of the Whence Came You podcast for the year 2020. Or for you Masonic nerds out there, AL6020. Let me ask, any Masonic secretaries out there accidentally ever write in 6020 or, you know, the Masonic year on regular document that you're dating? I have caught myself a few times, mostly in the past when I was busier with 300 members as a secretary of a lodge. But it's kind of funny, when we dive into Freemasonry, sometimes we start to just live our whole lives like that. Have you ever thrown a piece of garbage away and said in your head, delete, you know, because you're so used to working with a computer? I have. I don't know if that's sad or funny. Maybe both. As you heard in the top of the show, we've got a great one for you this week. I want to go ahead and thank our producers, our fellows, our contributors, and anybody else out there who is considering supporting this show. How do you support this show? Well, you head on over to WCYpodcast.com. At the top, click on Support the Show, and you will see whether you want to do it on Patreon or on PayPal, ways to support the show. You can become a contributor, a fellow, a producer, or even a legacy partner, which allows you to work with me to direct an entire episode annually. My thanks goes out to anybody out there who did check out the Intellectual Linear Progression for their open enrollment. And just for logistical reasons I mentioned already, but I wanted to tell you once more so that you are aware, this is the last episode of the podcast, Whence Came You, for 2020. The next podcast will air on January 10th. So you'll have a couple weeks with nothing on the WCY. Of course, Midnight Freemasons will still be up and running, and all of the other great things. So on the 27th, no episode. On the 3rd, no episode. Why? Well, that's just my 2 weeks off I take every year. I want to go ahead and just let you know that. But we'll be back with force coming 2021. Now, last week, we began to read a text. The text was Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel. And we started with part one, the tabernacle in the wilderness, and chapter one is what we read. Today, we are going to read chapter two, which continues the talk about the tabernacle in the wilderness. So, without any further delay, let's get into the next chapter. Chapter two, Brazen, Altar, and Laver. The brazen altar was placed just inside the eastern gate, and it was used for the sacrifice of animals during the temple service. The idea of using bulls and goats as sacrifices seemed barbaric to the modern mind, and we cannot realize that they could have ever had any efficacy in that respect. The Bible does indeed hear out this view of the matter, for we are told repeatedly that God desires not sacrifice but a broken spirit and a contrite heart, and that he has no pleasure in sacrifices of blood. In view of this fact, it seems strange that sacrifices should ever have been commanded. But we must realize that no religion can elevate those whom it is designed to help if its teachings are too far above their intellectual or moral level. To appeal to a barbarian, religion must have certain barbaric traits. A religion of love could not have appealed to those people, therefore they were given a law which demanded an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. There is not in the Old Testament any mention whatever of immortality, for these people could not have understood a heaven nor aspired to it. But they loved material possessions, and therefore they were told that if they did right, they and their seed should dwell in the land forever, that their cattle should be multiplied, etc. They loved material possessions, and they knew that the increases of the flock were due to the Lord's favor and given by Him for merit. Thus they were taught to do right in the hope of a reward in this present world. They were also deterred from wrongdoing by the swift punishment which was meted out to them in retribution for their sins. This was the only way to reach them. They could not have done right for the sake of right, nor could they have understood the principle of making themselves living sacrifices. And they probably felt the loss of an animal for sin, as we would feel the pangs of conscience because of wrongdoing. The altar was made of brass, a metal not found in nature but made by man from copper and zinc. Thus, it symbolically shown that sin was not originally contemplated in our scheme of evolution and is an anomaly in nature as well as its consequences, pain and death, symbolized by the sacrificial victims. But while the altar itself was made from metals artificially compounded, the fire which burned thereon unceasingly was of divine origin, and it was kept alive from year to year with the most zealous care. No other fire was ever used, and we may note with profit that when two presumptuous and rebellious priests dared to disregard this command and use strange fire, they met with an awful retribution and instant death. When we have once taken the oath of allegiance to the mystic master, the higher self, it is extremely dangerous to disregard the precepts then given. When the candidate appears at the eastern gate, he is poor, naked, and blind. He is at that moment an object of charity, needing to be clothed and brought to the light. But this cannot be done at once in the mystic temple. During the time of his progress from the condition of nakedness until he has been clothed in the gorgeous robes of the high priest, there is a long and difficult path to be traveled. The first lesson which he is taught is that man advances by sacrifices alone. In the Christian mystic initiation, when Christ washes the feet of his disciples, the explanation is given that unless the minerals decomposed and were offered us as embodiments for the plant kingdom, we should have no vegetation. Also, did not the plant food furnish sustenance for the animals? These later beings could not find expression, and so on. The higher is always feeding on the lower. Therefore, man has a duty to them, and so the master washes the feet of his disciples, symbolically performing for them the menial service as a recognition of the fact that they have served him as stepping stones to something higher. Similarly, when the candidate is brought to the brazen altar, he learns the lesson that the animal is sacrificed for his sake, giving its body for food and its skin for clothing. Moreover, he sees the dense cloud of smoke hovering over the altar and perceives within it a light, but that light is too dim, too much enshrouded in smoke, to be of permanent guidance to him. His spiritual eyes are weak, however, and it would not do to expose them at once to the light of greater spiritual truths. We are told by the Apostle Paul that the tabernacle in the wilderness was a shadow of greater things to come. It may therefore be of interest and profit to see what is the meaning of this brazen altar, with its sacrifices and burning flesh, to the candidate who comes to the temple in modern times. In order that we may understand this mystery, we must first grasp the one great and absolutely essential idea which underlies all true mysticism, that these things are within and not without. Angelus Silesius says about the cross, quote, "Though Christ 1,000 times in Bethlehem be born, and not within thyself thy soul will be forlorn. The cross on Golgotha thou lookest to in vain, unless within thyself it be set up again." End quote. This idea must be applied to every symbol and phase of mystic experience. It is not the Christ without that saves, but the Christ within. The tabernacle was built at one time. It is clearly seen in the memory of nature when the interior sight has been developed to a sufficient degree, but no one is ever helped by the outward symbol. We must build the tabernacle within our own hearts and consciousness. We must live through, as an actual inner experience, the whole ritual of service there. We must become both the altar of sacrifice and the sacrificial animal lying upon it. We must become both the priest that slays the animal and the animal that is slain. Later, we must learn to identify ourselves with the mystic laver, and we must learn to wash therein in spirit. Then we must enter behind the first veil, minister in the east room, and so on through the whole temple service till we become the greatest of all these ancient symbols, the Shekinah glory, or it will avail us nothing. In short, before the symbol of the tabernacle can really help us, we must transfer it from the wilderness of space to a home in our hearts, so that when we have become everything that the symbol is, we shall also have become that which it stands for spiritually. Let us then commence to build within ourselves the altar of sacrifice. First, that we may offer upon it our wrongdoings, and then expiate them in a crucible of remorse. This is done under the modern system of preparation for discipleship by an exercise performed in the evening and scientifically designed by the Hierophants of the Western Mystery School for the advancement of the aspirant on the path which leads to our discipleship. Other schools have given a similar exercise, but this one differs in one particular point from all previous methods. After explaining the exercises, we shall also give the reason for this great and cardinal difference. This special method has such a far-reaching effect that it enables one to learn not only the lessons which one should ordinarily learn in this life, but also attain a development which otherwise could not be reached until future lives. After retiring for the night, the body is relaxed. This is very important, for when any part of the body is tense, the blood does not circulate unimpeded. Part of it is temporarily imprisoned under pressure. As all spiritual development depends upon the blood, the maximum effort to attain soul growth cannot be made when any part of the body is in tension. When perfect relaxation has been accomplished, the aspirant to the higher life begins to review the scenes of the day, but he does not start with the occurrences of the morning and finish with the events of the evening. He views them in reverse order. First, the scenes of the evening, then the events of the afternoon, and lastly, the occurrences of the morning. The reason for this is that from the moment of birth, when the child draws its first complete breath, the air which is inspired into the lungs carries with it a picture of the outside world. And as the blood courses through the left ventricle of the heart, each scene of life is pictured upon a minute atom located there. Every breath brings with it new pictures. And thus, there is engraved upon that little seed atom a record of every scene and act in our whole life, from the first breath to the last dying gasp. After death, these pictures form the basis of our purgatorial existence. Under the conditions of the spirit world, we suffer pangs of conscience so acute that they are unbelievable for every evil deed we have done, and we are thus discouraged from continuing on a path of wrongdoing. The intensity of the joys which we experience on account of our good deeds act as a goad to spur us on the path of virtue in future lives. But in the post-mortem existence, this panorama of life is reenacted in reverse order for the purpose of showing first the effects and then the causes which generated them, that the spirit may learn how the law of cause and effect operates in life. Therefore, the aspirant, who is under the scientific guidance of the elder brothers of Rosicrucians, is taught to perform his evening exercise also in reverse order and to judge himself each day, that he may escape the purgatorial sufferings after death. But let it be understood that no mere perfunctory review of the scenes of the day will avail. It is not enough when we come to a scene where we have grievously wronged somebody that we just say, "Well, I feel rather sorry that I did it. I wish I had not done it." At that time, we are the sacrificial animal lying upon the altar of burnt offerings. And unless we can feel in our hearts the divinely enkindled fire of remorse burn to the very marrow of our bones because of our wrongdoings during the day, we are not accomplishing anything. During the ancient dispensation, all of the sacrifices were rubbed with salt before being placed upon the altar of burnt offerings. We all know how it smarts and burns when we accidentally rub salt into a fresh wound. This rubbing of salt into the sacrifices in that ancient mystery temple symbolized the intensity of the burning, which we must feel when we, as living sacrifices, place ourselves upon the altar of burnt offerings. It is a feeling of remorse, a deep and sincere sorrow for what we have done, which eradicates the picture from the seed atom and leaves it clean and stainless, so that as under the ancient dispensation, transgressors were justified when they brought to the altar of burnt offerings a sacrifice which was there burnt. So we, in modern times, by scientifically performing the evening exercises of retrospection, wipe away the record of our sins. It is a foregone conclusion that we cannot continue evening after evening to perform this living sacrifice without becoming better in consequence and ceasing little by little to do the things for which we are forced to blame ourselves when we have retired for the night. Thus, in addition to cleansing us from our faults, this exercise elevates us to a higher level of spirituality than we could otherwise reach in the present life. It is also noteworthy that when anyone had committed a grievous crime and fled to the sanctuary, he found safety in the shadow of the altar of sacrifice, for there only the divinely enkindled fire could execute judgment. He escaped the hands of man by putting himself under the hand of God. Similarly also, the aspirant who acknowledges his wrongdoing nightly by fleeing to the altar of living judgment thereby obtains sanctuary from the law of cause and effect. And though his sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. The Brazen Laver. The brazen laver was a large basin which was always kept full of water. It is said in the Bible that it was carried on the backs of 12 oxen, also made of brass, and we are told that their hind parts were toward the center of the vessel. It appears from the memory of nature, however, that those animals were not oxen but symbolical representations of the 12 signs of the zodiac. Humanity was at that time divided into 12 groups, one group for each zodiacal sign. Each symbolic animal attracted a particular ray, and as the holy water used today in Catholic churches is magnetized by the priest during the ceremony of consecration, so also the water is in this laver was magnetized by the divine hierarchies who guided humanity. There can be no doubt concerning the power of the holy water prepared by a strong and magnetic personality. It takes on or absorbs the effluvia from his vital body, and the people who use it become amenable to his rule in a degree commensurate to their sensitiveness. Consequently, the brazen lavers in the ancient Atlantean mystery temples, where the water was magnetized by divine hierarchs of immeasurable power, were a potent factor in guiding the people in accordance with the wishes of these ruling powers. Thus the priests were in perfect subjection to the mandates and dictates of their unseen spiritual leaders, and through them the people were made to follow blindly. It was required of the priests that they wash their hands and feet before going into the tabernacle proper. If this command was not obeyed, death would follow immediately on the priests entering into the tabernacle. We may therefore say that as the key word of the brazen altar was justification, so the central idea of the brazen laver was consecration. Quote unquote, many are called, but few are chosen. We have the example of the rich young man who came to Christ asking what he must do to be perfect. He asserted that he had kept the law, but when Christ gave the command, "Follow me," he could not, for he had many riches which held him fast, as in a vice. Like the great majority, he was content if he could only escape condemnation, and like them, he was too lukewarm to strive for commendation merited by service. The brazen laver is the symbol of the sanctification and consecration of the life to service. As Christ entered upon his 3 years ministry through the baptismal waters, so the aspirant to service in the ancient temple must sanctify himself in the sacred stream which flowed from the molten sea. And the mystic mason endeavoring to build a temple without sound of hammer, and to serve therein must also consecrate himself and sanctify himself. He must be willing to give up all earthly possessions, that he may follow the Christ within. Though he may retain his material possessions, he must regard them as a sacred trust to be used by him as a wise steward would use his master's possessions. And we must be ready in everything to obey this Christ within when it says, "Follow me," even though the shadow of the cross looms darkly at the end, for without this utter abandonment of the life, to the light, to the higher purposes, there can be no progress. Even as the Spirit descended upon Jesus when he arose from the baptismal waters of consecration, so also the mystic mason who bathes in the laver of the molten sea begins dimly to hear the voice of the Master within his own heart, teaching him the secrets of the craft. that he may use them for the benefit of others. Well, there you have Chapter 2 of Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel. Something that is often famous within spiritualism as it existed in the early 20th century is a blending of a lot of different systems and philosophical views and even religions to comprise something that is an amalgamation of all, to give a reason why all roads lead to the same center. Now, in this particular writing, of course, it's kind of this mystic Christian text. So what's being alluded to here is this idea of Christ within. Not the literal Jesus, but the anointed one or the higher self, and how we are paying attention or listening to it. Maybe it's like the Hierophant within the tarot. Maybe it's just this idea of intuition or your inner self or the Adam Kadmon. You know, whatever this idea is, the original perfect man, we're supposed to listen to him. So your question for this week for Craftsman Plus, and anybody else out there who chooses to answer the question, is two parts for the first question. Do you feel like you are in touch with the inner Christ? Do you find that you listen to your intuition, the higher self? And describe a time in your own life where you were both the sacrificer and the sacrificee, where you place yourself on the altar of sacrifice and sacrificed something. Now, that thing could be material, it could be spiritual, it could be psychological, but let's explore it a little bit, and I really look forward to reading your answers. And now, let's go ahead and get into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, the last one of the year. Let's check it out.
A man of many titles, Alexander Pavlovich, better known as Alexander I, served as Emperor of Russia beginning in 1801. During his term, he also became Grand Duke of Finland, King of Poland, and Grand Duke of Lithuania, positions which he held concurrently until his death. He was a busy guy. Although details of his initiation are sketchy, he was said to be a member of Canongate Kilwinning Lodge of Edinburgh, Scotland. There is no doubt, however, he was a member of the craft in Poland. Alexander was a generous donor to the Grand Orient of Poland, and in 1815 he attended a banquet which Polish Masons gave in his honor. Born in St. Petersburg, he was the grandson of Catherine the Great, who had reigned as empress for 34 years until her death in 1796. Alexander's father, Paul I, succeeded her. Paul's attempts to reel in the aristocracy and, at the same time, establish reforms and grant rights to the peasant class alienated many of his trusted advisors. Members of the nobility became increasingly wary of Paul's attempts to govern and developed a plot to overthrow him. On March 11, 1801, a group of soldiers, whom Paul had dismissed, cornered him in his bedroom at St. Michael's Castle and attempted to force him to abdicate. When Paul refused, they brutally murdered him. 23-year-old Alexander was in the castle at the time, and as the assassins left, instead of murdering him as well, confronted the new emperor with the warning, "It's time for you to grow up." Paul I had distrusted Freemasonry, and within a few years of becoming emperor, he banned the fraternity and all other secret societies. With Paul's death, the craft flourished under Alexander's reign. Alexander pulled back on his father's reforms, but at the same time began to take measures to monitor the activities of the upper class, which had killed his father. Eventually, like his father, his distrust of the Masons grew, and he also banned Freemasonry. A brother named Johann Baber, who later became Grand Master of Russia, spoke up for the craft and convinced Alexander to reverse the ban. For years after that, Freemasonry grew in Russia with Brother Alexander as an enthusiastic participant. Once the crisis that brought him into office subsided, Alexander became more liberal in his views, again raising concerns among the aristocrats. A series of events over the years, including an attempt at kidnapping him, the murder of one of his agents, and rumblings of a revolutionary conspiracy, rekindled his concern. At the same time, his mental health began to deteriorate. He was reported to have become withdrawn and passive, showing signs of paranoia. With all those factors in play, on August 1, 1822, he again banned Freemasonry. While on a sea voyage, 47-year-old Alexander died of typhus on December 1, 1825. There are other reports of brothers in positions of power who have banned Freemasonry. But Brother Alexander Pavlovich may hold the distinction of being the only Freemason who banned the fraternity twice. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic.
All right, how about that? A Freemason who banned Freemasonry two times. Fantastic stuff. Now, some of you heard how Alexander died of typhus. What is typhus? Well, typhus is an infectious disease, and it's transmitted by lice and ticks, mites, rats, fleas of rats, rather, and you get a purple rash, you get headaches, fever, and delirium. So this is what he eventually died of. And it's common during times of famine and war. If you like these kinds of interesting stories, again, please check out the bookstore on WCYpodcast.com. It is a place where you can find the books that are written by people on the show, including illustrious Brother Harrison. His books are there. If you click through our links, they're all Amazon. We do have an Amazon affiliate, so, you know, every couple years I might get a couple pennies from them. But the most important thing is that getting that information into your hands to quench your thirst in Masonic interests. Now, Steve's got a number of books up there. Two of my favorites that I always talk about, of course, that I always mention, being Freemasons at Oak Island and Tales from the Craft. Both phenomenal books. If you're looking for really amazing history, you cannot go wrong with the Denslow set. I will make sure I put a link in the show notes to grab those books, but also links back to the Missouri Lodge of Research, who publishes those, and Steve Harrison is the editor of these texts. Big thanks goes out to illustrious Brother Harrison for all he's done for our podcast and what he continues to do for the fraternity. Before we jump into the next text, I would love to tell you about something kind of cool, and that is, last week I told you all that I would be giving you something cool if you listen to the show, for everybody who listens. So if you download the podcast source application, search for Whence Came You inside of it, the bonus features I have included this month is a text called The Arcane Schools, a review of their origin and antiquity, with a history of Freemasonry and its relation to the theosophic, scientific, and philosophic mysteries by John Yarker. Who is John Yarker? Well, if you know anything about I don't want to say clandestine, but some interesting Masonic orders. Way back in the day, John Yarker is your Huckleberry. Now, I have OCR'd the text, so it's all chunked out and it looks really nice for you. It's not just a block of text. So you'll be able to take that and you can put it on your Kindles or your Remarkables or whatever you're doing your reading on these days. And it's a pretty fascinating paper. I say paper, I mean, it's 381 pages. So check that out. That is for anybody who listens to this show. Now, for anybody who is a contributor to the show, a fellow, a producer, legacy partner, whether you support us on Patreon or you support us on PayPal, there is a special book that's being given to you all. So for you, I want to thank you guys. If you sign up on Patreon, then this very night as this episode is airing, a post went up on Patreon, which has the file Masonic Initiation by W.L. Wilmshurst. It is the original PDF. It's been cleaned up and, of course, OCR'd for you all. What does that mean? It means you can search. You can hit Control F on your computer and you can search, and the words are all in there, so you can actually find the words you're looking for, a particular section. Now, W.L. Wilmshurst's book is about 136 pages, not quite as long as Yarker's, but Masonic Initiation is a favorite of mine, and it is a favorite of many people. In fact, you know who really likes this book? Chuck Dunning really likes this book. You can ask him about it. But this book is being posted in the Patreon. It is being emailed to all of our PayPal subscribers. So if you support us on PayPal, then you're going to get an email from me, wcypodcast@gmail.com, that says, Happy Holidays. And when you open that up, there'll be an attachment. Masonic Initiation by Wilmshurst will be there for you. And in Patreon, it'll be as a post. And of course, I'm also going to post the file for download in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. So wherever you are, you know, we're making it real easy to get it. And just my gift to you guys, thank you so much for all of your assistance over the last year. It's what I can do to show my appreciation. So check that out at your earliest. Now, next up, we have from 1934, dated December 1st. It's the monthly letter that Manly P. Hall would write up and print and mail out. And so this comes from the Phoenix Press, Los Angeles, California. Again, December 1st, 1934. It's called A Monthly Letter. That is what they were all titled. And they are Devoted to Spiritual and Philosophical Problems by Manly P. Hall. No, he has not created the Spiritual and Philosophical Problems. the letter is by Manly P. Hall. Sorry if that sounded funny to you. But here we go. Dear friend, in our last letter, we examined the subject of ethics in an effort to discover the nature of good. This month, we must seek that cause in man, which was defined in the ancients as the fountain of ever-flowing good. Psychology is the fourth department of philosophy and comprehends the entire field of what is now called mental phenomena. The word psychology actually means the voice, language, or science of the soul, but this original meaning is now, for the most part, disregarded, and a new definition has been formulated which limits psychology to the consideration and analysis of the mind and its reflexes. When a department of learning passes from a theoretical to a so-called practical state, it is said to cease to be an art and becomes a science. The modern psychologist, therefore, regards himself as a scientist rather than a philosopher. It is very questionable, however, whether psychology will ever be as useful as a science as it would be if it were perfected as a philosophy. The virtue of science lies in the intensity of its penetration. The virtue of philosophy lies in the breadth of its viewpoint. Mystical and metaphysical psychology was developed in India and Egypt and finds its most perfect expression in the transcendentalism of Plato and Proclus. After the decadence of classical learning, mystical psychology continued as an aspect of Christian metaphysics. During the Middle Ages, it dominated Christian viewpoints. This branch of learning was particularly cultivated by the medieval Rosicrucians. Among its ablest exponents were Paracelsus, Jacob Bohm, and Robert Fludd. By the beginning of the 18th century, metaphysical speculations were declining in the face of scientific viewpoint. The physical universe was discovered. The ancients viewed the material world as impermanent and comparatively unimportant. They took the attitude that man's spiritual existence was eternal and his material existence only a matter of 3 or 4 score years. Consequently, they wasted little time on man's temporal state. In the beginning of the 19th century, all this was changed. Man's spiritual perception was turned over to the tender keeping of a static theology, and his physical life became the sole object of so-called exact learning. This eclipse of mysticism produced an unbalanced viewpoint, which deprived a great part of humanity of the balanced concept of life. By the middle of the 19th century, metaphysical organizations began to appear. The memberships of these groups were largely made up of conscientious objectors revolting against the insufficiency of material science as a substitute for philosophy and mysticism. By the beginning of the 20th century, metaphysicians had become more or less a class apart. The majority of nominally educated and civilized people were hopelessly enmeshed in efficiency and prosperity complexes. Since the economic collapse of 1929, the interest in philosophy in all its branches has greatly increased, and before the end of the present century, we may expect a renaissance of metaphysical psychology. We may therefore formulate two definitions of psychology to distinguish the two methods of approach, ancient and modern. Ancient psychology sought to examine soul as the medium between the spirit and body. Modern psychology, accepting the mind as the origin of man's rational and reasonable existence, seeks to analyze and classify its processes and consequences. Ancient psychology derives its authority directly from metaphysics, modern psychology from physics. Mystical psychology may be outlined as follows. The universe in its three parts manifests the triune nature of that divine essence, from which all beings have their origin, by which they are sustained and into which they are finally merged. According to Aristotle, all intelligent men honor God after the number of three, by natural instinct. The three qualifications of the divine constitution are termed worlds, and together make up a macrocosm, or universal wholeness. According to the Rosicrucians, the three parts of the world are as follows. 1. The imperial heaven, the eternal and unchanging spiritual essence, the source and support of all life. 2. The starry or ethereal region, which is emanated from the imperial heaven, and was termed by the Chaldeans the second, or administering cause. 3. The elementary region, the sphere of effects, the formal world which receives into itself the impulses of the ethereal diffusion. Robert Flood declares the number 3 to represent the imperial root, the square of this number, the 9, the ethereal diffusion, and the cube of 3, 27, the elementary essences. These numbers, if added together, 27 plus 9 plus 3 equal 39, which, if Kabbalistically again added, equal 12. 12 represents the zodiac of celestial causes. The 1 and the 2 is again added, revealing Aristotle's divine root, the 3, and the cycle returns to its own source. The three regions, or conditions, of divinity, divine, ethereal, and elementary, are equivalent to the familiar terms spirit, soul, and body. Thus, soul corresponds to the ethereal diffusion, or sphere of secondary causes. As in the universe, so in man. The soul represents the medium binding man as a spiritual essence to man as a material body. The Platonists called the soul that general virtue which engenders and preserves all things, and in this definition Virgil also concurs. The alchemists referred to it as the bond of the elements. The spirit supports the soul, and the soul supports the body. The soul is always regarded as a vast organism containing within itself the source of all productiveness. Hermes infers this thought in his celebrated definition, quote, "The world, the soul, is the son of God, and the man is the son of the world," end quote. Ancient psychology, in consequence of this background, regarded the soul as a sensitive mirror in which the whole universe is reflected. The soul binds the individual personality to the heavens, the stars, and the planets. Disposition and temperament have their origin in the patterns which are set up in the soul by action and interaction of celestial and sidereal forces. The soul impinges itself upon the body through 7 vital centers and 7 essential processes. Some of the ancients went so far as to consider the soul of the individual as a complete superhuman entity. This is the Anthropos, the oversoul of Emerson, the god or daemon of Socrates, and the one-eyed Cyclops of Homer. The Alexandrian mystics, accepting the soul as a messianic individuality, considered union of the personality with its soul of the philosophical marriage. The same thought is contained in the Apocalypse of St. John, a writing undoubtedly inspired by Gnostic and Hermetic speculation. Here, the soul is referred to as the bridegroom, and again as the Lamb, the holy city, Jerusalem, which symbolizes the material body, is lifted up by their regeneration to become the bride of the Lamb, or to be reunited forever with its own oversoul. Pythagoras represented the soul by the ogdoad, or the number 8, According to him, it possessed 8 powers or attributes, of which 7 pertain to sense and cognition, and the 8th to generation or reproduction. These 8 represent the 7 planets and Earth. A secret is contained within this arrangement, for by it, the physical body of the man is viewed as the last or 8th extension of the soul. In the Mithraic rites of the Persians, the soul is represented by a ladder or 7 rungs, its upper end resting upon the spiritual nature and its lower end supported by the material world. The mental processes, which are now sole concern of psychology, were only one of the numerous manifestations of soul power in the ancient system of psychology. The soul was not only the origin of thought, but was the source of all manifestations of consciousness, from contemplation to imagination. The body itself, physically considered, was merely a mechanical instrument possessing neither perceptive nor reflective power. It is true that the body impulse, which motivates and enlightens it, originates in the soul. The experience which arises from action is recorded, not in the body, but in the soul itself. Evolution should therefore be regarded not as the growing of bodies or the unfoldment and development of bodies, but rather as soul growing up through bodies. It is the soul which knows and remembers. It is the soul which bestows wisdom upon the body out of experience. At death, the soul deserts the body, carrying away to its own essence all of the records of physical action. The purpose of ancient psychology was, therefore, to attempt by philosophical processes to distinguish the proper constitution of the soul itself, and to view it with the mind's eye in its separate aspects. The differentiation of the soul entity and its culture by philosophic discipline was the true and original field of psychology. Wise men, realizing that the flesh is weak and impermanent, invested as little as possible in the corporeal fabric. They sought rather to strengthen the soul's dominion over the body. They desired to so simplify bodily processes and mortal concerns that the soul had a maximum of freedom. Socrates believed that the unregenerate man, the soul, was mixed with the bodily principles. A Socratic illustration may be used. Considering the body as earth and the soul as water, the confusion of them results in mud or slime. Thus, the constitution of the unenlightened or uninitiated person was said to be murky or muddy. If, however, these elements are allowed to remain quiet for a certain length of time, they will separate. The mud and heavier particles will sink to the bottom, leaving the water upon the top completely clear. If, however, you agitate these elements, they will again become confused. The irrational impulses of the animal man are constantly riling and confusing the soul and body, but peace and tranquility of the wise allows the lower or bodily elements to settle to their own estate, and the soul becomes clear. Let us now compare this older concept of psychology with modern opinions on the subject. The term mind is now used to designate man's subjective, rational part. All processes, not admittedly physical, are presumed to be mental. The psychologist of the modern school does acknowledge a mental nature, not necessarily identical with the brain structure, nor resulting merely from the automatic activities of the brain. As to the exact nature of mind, definitions are hazy. In fact, modern psychology is better equipped to classify mental activities than it is to define the nature of the mind itself. Following the natural impulse described by Aristotle, the mind is psychologically considered as a threefold structure, even by the moderns. Where facts are lacking, opinions are usually numerous and contradictory. The several schools of modern psychology and psychological philosophy can scarcely be regarded as in agreement, and it would be almost impossible to find a common denominator for their conclusions. There is some agreement, however, upon the dimension of the mind into conscious, subconscious, and unconscious parts. Professor James of Harvard, probably the most famous psychologist of the modern school, was once asked for a definition of the subconscious mind. He declined to give a definition, on the ground that he had not yet discovered a satisfactory definition for the conscious mind. The opinion seems to be that the conscious mind is a term applicable to that department of mental process which is direct and evident. The surface of the intellect includes the field of phenomena in which the thoughts are consistent with evident facts and arise from adequate and evident causes. For example, Mr. A has a mental antipathy to Mr. B. Some time ago, Mr. B cheated Mr. A in business. Therefore, there is an evident, natural, and reasonable origin for Mr. A's attitude. Another example, a young person spends 20 years in school. Later in life, he demonstrates certain knowledge which is traceable to his schooling. Thus, in the thinking process, the cause is equal to the effect, and there is no particular mystery in the relationship of ideas. The second department of the mind is termed the subconscious. The subconscious mind is a field of obscure mental processes. The relationship between mental cause and effect is either distorted or obscured. Psychology acknowledges that there must be a cause for every effect, but mental refraction of ideas may disarrange the process of mental patterns. The factor of intensity appears. Two persons respond to a similar thought with differing degrees of intensity, according to the chemistry of temperament. Mental complexes are scars in the subconscious mind. Complexes distort and disproportion the values of ideas and are the most common cause of personal idiosyncrasies. The field of the subconscious mind lies behind the sphere of the conscious mental process, contributing attitudes. For example, Mr. A does not like Mr. B. Mr. B has never injured Mr. A. Therefore, the attitude is unexplainable without recourse to psychoanalysis. Or again, a person suffers throughout life from an inferiority complex which renders him incapable of normal social intercourse with others. The cause for such a condition may be traced to some comparatively insignificant incident in childhood, which has been distorted out of all proportion by the subconscious process of the mind. The third department of the mind, which is termed the unconscious, is regarded as the abstract causal sphere of the mind. It contains no thoughts, but is rather the reservoir of mental energies from which an active mental energy or virtue is constantly flowing into the subconscious and conscious parts of the mind. This sphere or pure mind defies anything that even approaches analysis, but is acknowledged as a hypothetical necessity in that all energies must have a source and all complexity must arise from essentially simple elements. Upon the principles of psychology, as now formulated, two more or less practical sciences have been established, psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Psychoanalysis, which in turn includes several more specialized fields, seeks to discover the keynote of individual consciousness by analyzing the conscious process and the subconscious complexes of the individual. The theory is pragmatic. Pragmatism assumes that the intrinsic nature of any force may be discovered by the consequences emanating from that force. This is modern Kabbalism. The ancient Jewish mystics declared that the substance of divinity could never be examined, but that God could be discovered through his works. In the same way, the rational man may never be examined by scientific processes, but its qualities may be approximated by an analysis of impulses, emotions, thoughts, and attitudes. Human beings group themselves into two general classes, introverts and extroverts. In the extrovert, impulse and action are closely related, and inhibitions and complexes are few. With the introvert, repression is the dominant keynote. Repression is closely allied to complexes. The introvert is generally a victim of tangled and distorted impulses which have found no outlet or expression through the conscious and mental processes. Psychotherapy is based upon the evident and undeniable premise that disorders in the mental life are bound to produce disastrous physical reflexes. Grief will break down cell structure, anger will decrease vitality, worry will prevent the knitting of bones, and a life which is victimized by mental irascibilities is bound to be physically inefficient. Many diseases are at least perpetuated by wrong thinking. In nearly all forms of sickness, recovery is retarded by the psychological inhibitions. Normalcy of thinking is the virtue greatly to be desired. The average person is less able to diagnose his mental ailments than he is to diagnose physical infirmities, which may afflict him. We live with our own thoughts so long as that we grow accustomed to them, no matter how bad they may be. Psychotherapy seeks to extend the life of man and enlarge his sphere of usefulness by putting the mind in order and freeing the intellect of its biases. and its false viewpoints. Very truly yours, Manly P. Hall. Well, there you have this complex paper that dissects these threefold nature of the mind and, in my opinion, attempts to rationalize the mystical elements of the mind. It's almost an idea that's been defined and then redefined and then redefined again, and he's showing how this most recent definition of a mystical practice is actually psychotherapy, in a way. Which is something that I find fascinating, just on the basis that, you know, I use tarot to assist me in reflecting on issues in my own life. If I pull the Tower card, and the Tower is supposed to represent a flash of intuition, or perhaps hearing, you know, the intuitive voice of the higher man or something, how does that relate to what's going on in my own life? Have I had intuitions about certain things? You know, so it's a process of breaking down doors and opening up other doors and closing some doors even. So very interesting. The second question I want to ask this week is, in all of Freemasonry, we seem to go through this conceptualization of an allegorical system, and then we have an epiphany later that says, oh, this can be applicable in my real life, and that's what we call, you know, practical uses for Freemasonry. Brother Juan Sepulveda has a great course on this. And what I find fascinating is that we generally don't think about this kind of thing much deeper than, say, the working tools or what the lesson is teaching us for today. But if we're taking mystical concepts and we're doing the same thing with those, practical mystical lessons, like what could that be? So my question for you then is, what mystical practices have you heard of that could relate to some practical form or practical use today? That's it for this week. I want to thank you guys for joining me. As always, I want to thank you all for a wonderful year of the podcast. And we're spreading Masonic light into the future. I really just can't thank you all enough. So, with that, I'm going to let you go. And I will talk to you guys all next year. So until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Happy New Year. Happy Holidays. And take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.